Right, so the way I see it, I'm here to kind of provide a little bit of a relief from the serious business of understanding the universe. So I just hope that the relief doesn't turn out to be too comic. Or rather, not understanding the universe, right? Okay, so this is based on the work I've done with Roberto Ampara and Alessandro Fabri and Twitch. Well, this is good enough. Alessandro Fabri and Juan Garcia Beito, and there are two papers on it. What is it about? So there were some interesting attempts, and perhaps even more interesting failures, to find out black holes localized on brains in this Randall syndrome type of two brain world. In other words, the cutoff ADS space, which had semi-infinite bulk, but nevertheless admitted a localized graviton. And if you look, I mean, there were on the other hand also some exact school solutions that were constructed by Efron, Horowitz, and Myers in a lower dimensional case where you start with ADS4 and end it on a two brain and get some kind of a two plus one dimensional theory, which did represent regular black holes. And that led to some interesting questions and puzzles, and we tried to understand what was going on. And so the topic of this talk emerges out of this story. And in order to get started, let me just give you a very brief introduction about the basics, the background, what's the arena in which we want to play this game. And the game will be played essentially by trying to understand this Randall syndrome 2 setup in a language that will try to follow as closely as possible the ADS-CFT correspondence. And in order to illustrate it, it's a good idea to build a kind of geometric picture that follows the correspondence as closely as possible. And so here is how one might want to think about Randall syndrome 2 setup. Take an ADS space in some number of dimensions. Confine your attention to the Poincaré patch. Confine your attention to the Poincaré patch, inside of which you know that you can describe the geometry by a line element which is conformally flat, and where the conformal factor depends only on the radial coordinate that you parameterize by basically picking one point. Essentially what you do to get the Poincaré patch, you take two null planes and you intersect them in such a way that they won't touch each other at one point on the boundary. And then that point corresponds to, if I remember correctly, z equals infinity. And z runs in an orthogonal direction towards the interior of the ADS space and becomes zero on the opposite side, on the boundary. And what Randall and Sundrum then do, of course, for this we know that there is a well-established ADS-CFT correspondence. And the question is now, how does that translate in the setup of Randall and Sundrum? They basically do the following thing. They take ADS space in Poincaré patch, and then they introduce a source, an extended object in the bulk, and parameterize this object with a stress energy tensor, which is completely localized corresponding to an infinitely thin brain, because it's a brain because it has the symmetries, the fourth dimensional Lorentz invariants in the longitudinal directions. And when they solve the procedure of solving Einstein's equations with this source in the bulk is completely analogous to performing the following trick. You take the Poincaré patch coordinates, you shift the radial direction z by a constant, and then after the shift, you cut it off by replacing the new radial variable by its absolute value. And this will give you precisely the solution of the Einstein's equations in the bulk with the delta function, stress energy tensor that satisfies the right symmetries. And the way to see it is basically remember that if you take two derivatives of an absolute value, you get a delta function, and the Einstein's equations essentially do it in a covariant way while respecting the longitudinal symmetries along the way. And of course, I mean, I'm basically, you know, digesting a few pages of calculation down to a simple statement, which is perhaps over-trivializing it. But nevertheless, that's how it works. And then, of course, Randall and Sundrum, what they do is they essentially what this then corresponds to is, by imposing specific boundary conditions for the geometry, corresponds to cutting out the exterior of a shell of the if you like, the volume trajectory which the brain depicts as it is embedded in the ADS space, identifying the two sides, which removes the infinite portion of the ADS space away from the story, only leaving a finite, infinite, semi-infinite in proper distance, but of finite volume on one side of the brain. And the reason this is interesting is that in this limit, if you consider the fluctuations of the bulk geometry, if you just locally look for the solutions, you will find a mode that would correspond to a zero graviton propagating along the brain, which is not normalizable in the whole ADS space, and hence in the whole ADS space essentially corresponds to a coupling constant in the dual CFT. But here it becomes normalizable and therefore propagating, and it turns out that because it has all the right symmetries, it is precisely the four-dimensional graviton. And the coupling that control, well, the coupling constant, the coupling parameter, which controls its couplings to the normal matter, is essentially set by the volume of the ADS space left after chopping this infinite portion out and defines the lower dimensional Planck scale. Now, so how do we go on from this to establish a closer connection with ADS CFT? Well, of course, the story is here complicated. Actually, I should first start with a different transparency. The story gets complicated by the fact that we have introduced this delta function source in the bulk, this brain, which corresponds to putting 4D gravity, and also an ultraviolet cutoff in the CFT by hand. Here is, however, the dictionary which people believe is correct. Essentially, before cutting the bulk, Maldacena tells us what we have at hand with his ADS-CFT correspondence, and the aspect of the correspondence that's going to be most relevant for the message that I would like to try to convey is basically the following statement, that the classical weak supergravity in ADS is dual to a quantum super Young Mills in a Minkowski space of one-dimensional Fewer in the strong coupling regime and two leading order in 1 over n, basically including planar diagrams. In other words, classical bulk configurations, if you look at ADS space and then perturb and look at some normalizable mode, the classical bulk configurations include quantum effects in the dual theory in this limit truncated to planar diagrams. Now, what happens after we put in the brain? Well, after we cut the ADS space, the idea is that this corresponds to an ADS CFT with a cutoff, which is set at some high scale, the ultraviolet. Cutoff is essentially set by the inverse ADS radius because of the choice of how we put the brain in the bulk. And also, to this you couple the d-dimensional gravity. On the bulk side, that was basically the newly normalizable mode which arose after cutting the volume to a finite volume. And on the dual side, what you will do is you just take your CFT, you cut it off in the UV, and then in addition, you couple minimally normal 4D graviton. And then also, you may or may not want to put additional localized gauge degrees of freedom on the brain itself. You may want to discuss them for model building purposes or not. And basically, for most of what I will be saying, I'll essentially tend to ignore this. Essentially, just focus on the sector of the theory, which is the CFT. And the reason that these degrees of freedom are tricky to deal with is they are highly model dependent. They basically depend on how you imagine you realize your cutoff, how much you imagine you realize your cutoff brain, you know, what you imagine the theory essentially behaves like above the cutoff scale. So now the prescription is take this, put in a cutoff, integrate out the CFT above it, and then also put d-dimensional gravity with a d-dimensional, lower dimensional Planck scale set basically by the ADS radius and a higher dimensional Planck scale. And again, if you want, put in some matter localized on the cutoff.
Yes. Am I supposed to think that the 1 over n expansion also controls the quantum fluctuations of the graviton localized on the brain?
I don't know. I mean, I think not. At least I don't know how to enforce it at this point. I don't think that's really under control, but what will turn out is that the quantum fluctuations of the graviton will be suppressed by 1 over n relative to the quantum fluctuations of the synchrotron. Essentially, just because there is so many more degrees of freedom on the synchrotron. So everything that I'll try to tell you about the quantum effects for the black hole will be valid up to that point where I'm not deleting anything from the localized graviton loops. Those are the things that I don't have under control and I don't know how to deal with, but I'm going to argue that, you know, quantitatively, they would actually be comparable to the two CFT effects. Just because, you know, you gain the 1 over n. So there is that intrinsic error, systematic error, that we are consciously making in everything we're trying to say.
Two loop or non-planar?
Non-planar, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. So now how do we define the CFT degrees of freedom? Again, the point is that we have in the dual theory, we think we have a strongly coupled CFT now with a cutoff, like presumably broken supersymmetry. And so it is extremely difficult to define that directly. So we resort to believing that the main properties of the CFT degrees of freedom after breaking supersymmetry and putting UV cutoff will not be violated if you break it by putting in some irrelevant operators that do not violate the symmetries. And hence, there should be the bulk dual where we have equicoupled supergravity, and so we define the strongly coupled CFT indirectly. We essentially, imagining the validity of the ADS description, define the strongly coupled CFT by basically looking at the fluctuations of the bulk modes that the original theory had. And there, for example, if you just look at the graviton sector, we have this sort of usual picture, familiar picture by now, where we have this volcano potential that corresponds to, that arises essentially because the brain sits in some language close to the ADS boundary and the degrees of freedom that are heavy in the bulk need to climb up the potential well to get there. Apart from the fact that there is also this localized graviton which spikes on the brain simply because that was the guy that was not normalizable in the original picture, it likes to live near the boundary. And then the statement is that the prescription is that some massive Kalousa Klein mode in the bulk corresponds to a CFT state at some energy set by the KK states, KK mode's mass, and furthermore that the coupling of the stuff that sits on the brain to that CFT degree of freedom is essentially defined by the wave function overlap between the bulk mode and the degree of freedom that sits on the brain, and if you compute it, it's given essentially by a formula, by a product of the mass times the ADS rate. So in other words, if you take a guy which likes to sit out near the center of the ADS space, that guy will couple very weakly, exponentially weakly, compared to the localized gravity to anything that sits on the brain. And now, okay, given this dictionary, we can ask, all right, are there some ways for us to check whether it makes sense? There are kinds of calculations that you can try to do, using it to see whether the results that you anticipate getting on doing, you know, looking at the same effect from the different dual pictures, agree. And one check that people have actually looked and you know, did very nice calculations is the corrections to the Newtonian potential between two masses that are stuck on the brain in the linearized approximation that arise from the exchange of bulk gravitons, which in the dual CFT correspond to vacuum diagram polarizations, graviton vacuum diagram polarizations coming from the CFT block. And they computed it on both sides and actually find that the two sides indeed agree using this dictionary. And finding that essentially at large distances the corrections drop is 1 over r squared, which is controlled, if you like, by conformal solution. So now the natural question to ask is, okay, so what happens to black holes? So we're saying we have a theory which does possess a lower dimension on gravity. So unlike original ADS CFT on Mondasena, in this case in the dual theory there is gravity as well, because this graviton bulk became normalizable, it's localized on the brain and so on. So then you would say, well, if gravity is dynamical, meaning if the dual theory has more than three space-time dimensions, there must exist. I mean, it's logical to assume that there should be black holes. Like you get ADS 5, dual theory is CFT in four dimensions plus normalized and gravity, you should have Schwarz's solution. These black holes should be localized to the brain. And the reason is that basically it's very easy to find solutions which have whose metric induced on the brain has a regular horizon. These would be just warped Schwarzschild strings through the bulk. However, these solutions aren't localized. They extend all the way out to the ADS boundary on the opposite side. And if you look carefully at the bulk geometry, you find out that actually the path horizon is not regular. It's a singularity. It's a non-singularity. And what that suggests is perhaps a way to say why you would want to dismiss these as the, well, first of all, there is the issue of instability, and it has been argued by Chamberlain, Hawking, and Rial that because of these instabilities, these singular extended solutions would tend to break up and form essentially solutions with regular horizons on the brain. Perhaps another way to argue that these solutions should not be viewed as localized black holes is that if you think about the dual interpretation of the horizon in the ADS bulk on the dual side, that geometry essentially defines the vacuum state of the CFD. If you had made it singular by putting a local black hole, I mean, it doesn't make sense. If you take a local black hole, build a black hole in this room, you should not have altered the properties of the vacuum at infinity. And that's what this black stream does. It certainly alters the properties of the vacuum at infinity. So Chamberlain, Hawking, Rial, and also other people.
What you mean at infinity out along the...
The brain.
Along the brain, okay. So say again.
So...
briefly.
Right, so
I'm just going to try to draw a picture the way I remember this.
You see, it turns the Cauchy horizon in the bulk.
Yeah. Use this picture.
So this thing becomes singular, and that's singular everywhere. Right? And so therefore that's, yeah. You know, you have to worry about specifying special boundary conditions for the theory there and so on and so forth. It doesn't look like vacuum. Especially if you define the vacuum by the empty areas. So you've done something too dramatic. So now a number of people, including these authors, have therefore conjectured that there should exist. You know, there was a lot of unpublished stuff, discussions on, that there should exist these localized pancake-like black holes. And that's the situation, let's say, what you would expect if the dual theory has more than three space-time dimensions. On the other hand, if you consider the example where the dual theory is three-dimensional, only 2 plus 1, then you know that in that case, you don't have a dynamical graviton. In 2 plus 1, gravity is a transimal theory without a propagating degree of freedom. And so in a asymptotically flat space, you know there aren't any black holes, and there is a famous theorem of Desert, Jacquier, and Toff to that extent. And now, you know, you build your prejudice on the basis of this, your expectations, and then you look around and see what people have found, poking around the bulk, looking for these solutions. And then there is a surprising, you know, outcome, where if you look at the bulk picture, these expectations appear to be, at first sight, a complete failure. Why? Well, in fact, in more than three dimensions of dual theory, to date, no one has found exact black hole solutions. And to make things even more confusing, there are people who claim that you can't form, by collapsing matter on the brain, a static, spherically symmetric, asymptotically flat black hole.
And what's the basis for that claim? Can you summarize that briefly?
Sure. I'll actually go over that in a lot more detail, because one of the reasons why we did it was actually to demystify this. But what they roughly found is essentially they did the Oppenheimer-Snyder type of collapse of a cloud of mass, which they assumed has interior described by these bulk equations projected on the brain, and found a term that prevented them from matching it on a Schwarzschild static exterior. There was an obstruction, in other words. And the obstruction, I mean, one of the points of the talk is to actually try to say what the obstruction means.
Sorry,
That just proves that the exterior can't be static during the collapse. It doesn't prove that it can't settle down to something static after the collapse is coming.
Well, they don't have the exterior to match on because they don't have the short.
No, they proved that the exterior during the collapse can't be static.
That's what they proved.
Yeah, they eventually proved that there were no static black holes.
But didn't you also tell us a few transparent ago, I wouldn't expect it to be Schwarzschild?
No, Schwarzschild black string. I would not expect it to be Schwarzschild, but Schwarzschild black string.
What did they match on to then? What were they turning on?
There is the issue whether there are the one thing that's interesting is whether there is a possible small correction, small deviation, which external Schwarzschild solution to which you could match to. As far as I understand from their analysis, they failed to find one such thing. Now, when I say they had a theorem, I actually mean it under the quotation marks because there are holes you can poke in that theorem. And one of the things that we try to do is actually find some logical way of poking additional holes and understanding some physics, which could lead to a more consistent interpretation. So, I'm not going to answer all of those questions because I don't know those answers. Put this way. I think we have one consistent answer. At the moment, I don't think I can firmly rule out other possibilities with certainty, but given the form of the answer that we arrived at, I think that the other possibilities, meaning the existence of a static black hole, are a little bit unlikely. But, you know.
Excuse me, but yes. I'm a little lost. I mean, now you're talking about this pancake light?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm a little bit confused. Gravity on the brain is four-dimensional plus corrections. And we know pretty much when these corrections are important and when they are not important. So you would expect, in fact, that of course you will never get something that is exactly the black hole.
That's right.
It will have a correction. If this is not very massive, the correction will be small and the leak into the bulk will be small, and if it's the mass is very large, then it will leak mostly into the bulk. Is that wrong?
That, in fact, is precisely, you see, no, this is not wrong, but I want to tell you very specific. You see, this kind of thinking is exactly what led to me to actually consider ways of understanding this result in a physically meaningful sense. So that, you know, the elaborate version of that argument is what I want to talk about.
So could we say, yet another way, same thing. Is it no longer true that Birkhoff's theorem holds on the brain because you can radiate out into the
brain? Yes. That's correct. Exactly. That, in fact, was, you know, this is essentially how this theorem has been formulated as a obstruction to the Birkhoff theorem, using those brain projected equations, precisely. Now, on the other hand, in the case of the three-dimensional dual theory, the exact solutions corresponding to static black holes asymptotically far space, localized on the brain, looking like pancakes in the box, were actually found by Emparan, Horowitz, and Rob. And, you know, that on the other hand seems to contradict the old result of Jacquive, Desser, and Toff. So now, the statement, okay, so the question is clearly, well, if this is really completely the opposite of what we should have expected. And the answer is, if you think about, you know, the physics at hand, is that actually our expectations were somewhat misleading. And the reason is that we ignored building up those expectations, those false expectations that I used as a motivation to think about the problem. We ignored quantum mechanics. We ignored ADS-CFT. Basically, the resolution is that the bulk solutions, as we said, as Baldassena taught us, the classical bulk solutions correspond to solutions in the dual CFT which are quantum correct to leading 1/n order. That means they include planar diagrams. And those bulk classical corrections should, in the dual picture, be viewed as quantum corrections coming from the CFT with V3. And so, if we want to develop certain, you know, intuitive expectation as to what these pancake black holes should look like, we should readjust our expectations to include these effects. And in other words, essentially start thinking about, when we're solving these Einstein's equations, about what kind of solutions we should expect when in the dual field, that means on the brain, so to speak, we include the quantum corrections to the stress energy potential and the Lacan polarization.
On the brain or on the...
In the dual theory. So
the dual theory.
In the dual theory.
About two different...
You see, the reason I'm talking about the two different things is that lots of that language has been incorrectly used in the literature. You know, there is, if you look at, you see, and I'll get into that actually in this transparency.
CFT is not on the brain, right?
CFT is not on the brain, you know, certainly. I mean, there is one picture or the other picture. Now, in the picture that I want to talk about, I'm actually ignoring all of those matter degrees of freedom that you would normally put on the brain. The only thing that, you know, kind of looks on the brain is, to be on the brain is the graviton. So, you know, on the brain term seems to refer to its solutions, that its equations of motion admit. But really there is no CFT on the brain. Now, so one hint of how to proceed comes when you actually look at these equations which govern the dynamics of the localized mode, graviton localized mode. So in particular, so by what you could do is you could take the classical bulk equations and imagine that there is some sources that are manifested by the fact that you get a non-zero bulk stress energy. These sources will deform the metric in some way from the pure ADS. And because you are now putting that your brain in there, that they will also deform the metric on the brain away from the Minkowski vacuum into some other configuration. And now you can ask the question about what kind of equations does that projection of the bulk metric onto the brain obey? And the idea was, well, if you have truly localized graviton in that theory, then those equations should be something like four-dimensional Einstein's equations plus a correction. And indeed, if you go through an arduous procedure of correctly projecting the full Einstein's equations in the bulk to the boundary, you find that the equation which the localized graviton obeys is something like four-dimensional gravity plus a correction which is quadratic in the stress energy tensor. The point, however, is that in the dual theory, which is the only theory that you should use to build up your four-dimensional, your lower dimensional equation, these are not kosher equations to play with, because the dual theory has, below the cutoff, for example, doesn't know what G5 is. In G5, the five-dimensional Huygens constant in the dual theory is just not a good variable. It makes no sense. So what you need to do in order to see what these equations tell you about the properties of the dual theory is actually translate this result into the language that is accessible to the variables that you have in the dual theory. And in particular, what you need to do is get rid of it by using the relationship, the Gauss law, which is relating 5D Newton's constant and the 4D Newton's constant, and the definition of the cutoff, that is the inverse ADS radius, while actually keeping track of all the powers of H bar in these equations, because if we are, you know, if our new expectation is right that these effects are of quantum origin, there should be powers of H bar floating around, so let's try to pin them down to see what it tells. Plus, we should also express the ADS radius, wherever it appears in some dimensionless combination, in terms of the number of the degrees of CFT degrees of freedom below the cutoff, because again, that is a meaningful quantity in terms of which we can express the results in the dual, on the dual side. And this relation is basically just obtained by taking Maldacena's result and then compactifying it down to first five and then four dimensions. So when you do that, you can take the five-dimensional Newton's constant that appears as a coefficient controlling that correction to the 4D Einstein's equation, and completely rewrite it in terms of the variables which are meaningful in the dual 4D theory, and lo and behold, you get powers of H bar. And in the dual theory, in fact, this is not what we did, this has already been discussed by a number of people who actually considered the dual interpretation of these corrections. In the dual theory, indeed, you want to think of these corrections as, in fact, the quantum corrections coming from a large number of CFT degrees of freedom. Of course, in the limit where G star is large, and that limit, again, is is needed in order to justify ADS CFT in the first place, because you need to have large ADS radius compared to the fundamental scale. So given these motivations, that leads us to a conjecture, which is that the black holes that solve classical bulk equations that are localized on the brain, that means obeying these imposed brain boundary conditions, should really correspond to quantum corrected solutions in the dual CFT plus gravity theory. And then the statement that you didn't find a static black hole actually start making sense, because you know you shouldn't find a static black hole or you know simple black hole solution because of the fact that you need to include quantum corrections. Now why do you worry about it?
Wait, sorry, the context in which you didn't find a static black hole was the classical bulk equation.
That's right. But you see, the people who actually looked for those black holes maintained their classical prejudice and essentially ignored. You see, they played with Ansatz. They made Ansatz that would make sense if you were looking for black holes in some classical theory where you knew that classical static solutions exist. What I'm getting at is, I'll make it a little bit more clear, but I'll screw my punchline a little bit, which is if you have Hawking radiation, you have a mass loss, right, from the black hole. So therefore, you don't expect to find a static black hole as a result. And if you look for one, certainly you're not going to find it. What I'm trying to say is basically that the black hole, that the corrections coming from the bulk encode the corrections from the Hawking radiation, and there really is energy loss.
But am I not allowed to just ask this question in the context of a classical brain embedded in ADS and get a sensible answer?
Yeah, you are. What I'm trying to tell you is from the right, you are. And now you look for these solutions, and all of the meaning are not you. People look at these solutions, they make what they think are meaningful answers. And they say, well, we can't find a black hole solution. Somehow we all always fail. All right? So now they have to find a classical answer why these black hole solutions were not found. What I'm trying to tell them is, I don't know how to do it classically from the bulk point of view, but if I believe in ADS CFT and the effective field theory interpretation of what I expect, I'm telling them why. Because of the fact that you should have expected the time dependence to develop as a result that in the dual theory, these solutions are actually time dependent to Hawking radiation.
There is no limit in which these corrections are small.
I'll discuss that.
There's an answer, yes or no, to this question.
The limit is actually subtle. All right? Yeah, I don't want to give you a clear answer You see, let's put it this way. The limit is, the reason it's subtle is that in the limit that I know how to do, I'm going to lose ADS CFT, so I have nothing to say about it. All right?
So the answer is no.
Well, in this picture,
you know, limit in which corrections are small.
As long as I have asymptotically ADS space away from the brain.
Okay.
Correct.
So from what you just said about Hawking radiation, you should expect to find extremal
dipoles? The answer is yes, but I don't know how. I mean, there was an example. Again, I'm sort of jumping ahead and ahead and ahead. It'll be a little bit easier to say things after certain things have been made. But I'll just say that there was some investigation by Porat in Ferrara. So, you know, I can give you a reference later. So if this is true, then, okay, let's check it. Let's see, you know, sort of start answering those questions with a little bit more detail on it, all right? Let's check it. So first of all, let's look at the black holes in D equals 3, right? In the dual theory. Now those solutions are known exactly, and they give us the best arena where we can check things, because given explicit solutions, you can actually compute things in a great deal of detail. So how have they been found? What Roberto, Gary, and Rob did is they basically took exact bulk solutions corresponding to symmetric in ADS4, which essentially corresponds to a pair of accelerating black holes through the ADS bulk. And then they have cleverly cut it by inserting the brain in between the two horizons, retaining only the completely regular horizon on the side of the ADS space. And indeed, the geometry in the bulk looks precisely like a pancake black hole bulging a little bit into the bulk, and you can actually find explicitly that it's the extent of the horizon in the bulk is logarithmically smaller than the horizon along the brain and so on and so forth. So the picture of the pancake makes sense. The black hole is accelerating away from the center in this case. Now, if you look at the metric induced on the brain that you get by taking this exact solution and cutting with the brain, you find that, in fact, it takes a very simple form. It's just the equatorial section of the four-dimensional Schwarzschild black hole with a deficit angle. That's the only modification. Now, the deficit angle is given, it measures the mass of the black hole, and the horizon is actually related to the mass with a complicated formula. It's not a simple linear function, except in the limit of mass is very small compared to the three-dimensional point mass. Now, if this idea that I'm talking about is right, then these black holes must be interpreted as arising completely from quantum corrections, because Bezerjak even told us that no such classical objects can exist. So how do we check whether this is true? What kind of picture do we adopt? Well, let's take a lump of energy, of CFT. We just, you know, force it to a point by hand, okay, just like a boundary condition, which has the same mass as the would-be black hole. Its classical geometry is that with a conical deficit angle, so it's just locally flat space with a deficit extending all the way to infinity. And that's what Bezerjak told us. However, now we have a conformal field theory without a cutoff. That means with large number of degrees of freedom that can get excited at an arbitrarily low temperature of an external source. And that's the point. As long as there is no gap, you can always access the degrees of freedom. Now, therefore, when you take that CFT and put it on the cone, one of the things that it will do is it will lead to the quantum corrections to the stress energy tensor from the Casimir effect. And you can take conformal field theory on the cone and compute these effects essentially, well, in the following sense, right? Of course, you should now ask, well, how do you compute, you know, stress energy tensor from a strongly coupled CFT when you don't really know how to define it? The thing is, what you could do is you take a prototype weakly coupled CFT, okay, a single scalar field with conformal couplings to the geometry, and you compute the stress energy tensor from that, and then you add the fermions and whatever else you need in order to at least to leading order supersymmetrize the theory, and you repeat it G star times, and you find out that the result that you get for the quantum correction to the stress energy tensor takes this form. In fact, this has been actually calculated in 1982, I think, by these people. And they have found a precise formula for this connection, for this coefficient as a function of the mass. Incidentally, the scaling as 1 over RQ is controlled by conformal symmetry, but so this is just the statement that the theory is conformally coupled. But the precise functional, G star, of course, is just linear superposition of quantum mechanics, all right? This precise functional form doesn't seem to have any direct connection to symmetries, nor does the tensorial structure that you get. So you plug this back in the Einstein's equations that originally gave you Kohn, you know, do it iteratively, include the back reactions, and solve again the Einstein's equations with this source inserted.
This is just faceless, right?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, amazingly, you get exactly the same solution as Amparan, Horowitz, and Myers.
Back on the last term principle. So you said the tensorial structure isn't dictated by the symmetry.
The translucence.
Oh, okay.
The translucence is the precise, you know, even if you require, because it's three coefficients. Right?
Yeah. So there, yeah, there's one arbitrary number.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And actually, sorry, the polarization calculation was done in 92. Then in 93, Harald Solen had actually taken that calculation, plugged it back in the 2 plus 1 Einstein's equations and found this black hole.
Isn't that a vacuum solution? And you have a TV new or?
No, it's not a vacuum solution. Yeah, I did that, the point, exactly. Okay. The thing is, because of this TMU new, right. If that TMU new were set equal to zero, now this is also in part to answer Rami's question, right? Now the limit loops, this is to take G star to zero, which means ABS radius to zero, and that's why I'm reluctant to do it. So now, the horizon is related to H bar, which indicates that it is of quantum origin. It is proportional to the number of CFT degrees of freedom, and its precise dependence on the mass is given by this formula, okay, which comes out from computing the vacuum polarizations. And it turns out that actually in the limit of small masses and large masses, masses that are comparable to the three-dimensional quantum scale, this is exactly of the same form, as you know, exactly this, not only scaling, but functional form in this case, of the result that is found by exact plot solutions in the paper by Roberto Gary and Rob.
In which limit?
So, very small masses, mm-hmm. and masses that are as large as they could possibly be, the limit being the fact that the conical deficit angle can be bigger than 4 pi. And the point is that, of course, up to order 1 coefficients. And in a sense, okay, we couldn't hope for more because of the fact that, you know, we are taking a result from a weakly coupled CFT and pushing by hand into a strong coupling regime, and those coefficients are not going to be under control. We know that from other situations where people have done these calculations, but the scaling, the functional form, and the tensorial structure coming out right is rather remarkable. A sort of side effect, a kind of spin-off, is that it turns out that the quantum corrections act as a cosmic sensor, as long as they're conformal. So that this is, it has an interesting kind of, notice the greater the number of CFT degrees of freedom, the better the censorship works, because it pushes the horizon away from the center of the solution. The story has a little bit of an interesting history, actually, because in fact, when Solang looked at the solution that he found by solving for the back reaction, for the case when he included the back reaction, and finally the solution looks like a black hole, since he was working with a single field, or rather with few fields, he actually found out that in most of his situations, in the limit of small masses, the curvature tensor was getting Planckian outside of the horizon. So he sort of dismissed this as a censorship, because he said, okay, look, in fact, even though it looks like a solution with a horizon, the solution is still not under control outside of the horizon, hence we can't really think of it. He missed one limit. He missed the fact that in the limit where you take, so he considered only this case, where the masses are much smaller than the 3D Planck scale. In fact, it turns out that in the case when you take the mass to be very large as it can be, in fact, the horizon rapidly zooms out and actually protects really protect the solution from the singularity, in the sense that the stress energy tensor, the curvature and everything are actually sub-Planckian outside the horizon. Now, clearly, the situation gets improved in the limit of many CFT degrees of freedom, because then you can actually protect even a small object from going, from developing large curvatures also. Now, we also did consider the black holes on brains, on bent brains in ADS4, the brains that were ADS3 in ADS4. Situation there was much more complicated, and actually, because I want to tell you a few other things, I'm not going to discuss it. Yes?
One question that comes up here, I think, especially since you say everything is non-supersymmetric.
Yes.
When you have quantum corrections due to a large number of fields, there is also have to be a large renormalization of the 3D Newton's constant. And you've sort of been identifying the 3D Newton's constant with the classical calculation of the 3D Newton's constant.
Right.
Does that somehow just fall out of all of your calculations in this parametric dependence? Or is
No. I mean, you know, I think that the answer is that the corrections will be done by G star. So, in the, but I don't know.
N equals zero. Yeah, I thought this was n equals zero.
Well, the other, you know.
But then, you break it. You put the larger limit.
You know, I think the way we wanted to think about it is that here's a field breaking supersymmetry. If we imagine supersymmetry is broken by an irrelevant operator, then in the limit of large masses, the breaking effects should be small. But, you know, I'm not sure if we have that fully under control. So let's say at the moment that probably the most honest answer is that we just ignore it. Now, turning to the question of four-dimensional space-time, that is four-dimensional dual theory, whose dual is AES5. So as we said, since in 4D you have dynamical gravity, you expect that there should exist a black hole, just a Schwarzschild, usual Schwarzschild black hole. And then you would say, okay, well, you know, as we said, if it's large enough, you know, who cares about the correction? The trick, of course, is that in asymptotically ADS space, these people have told us that they failed to find one solution. And now the question is, how should we understand, how should we motivate their failure in the light of ADS? How should we interpret their failure in the light of ADS? So here is the argument that we have come up with. Suppose that bulk is indeed ADS in the sense that supersymmetry is broken by relevant operators, and so that to lowest, you know, degree of approximation, the theory is nearly conformal in the infrared. That means that in the infrared, away from the brain, you have a regular horizon. You have asymptotically ADS geometry there in the Poincaré path. In that case, CFT is really conformal all the way to arbitrarily low energies, meaning there is no singularity which is terminating the bulk at some finite distance from the brain, and therefore there is no gap in the CFT. So these CFT degrees of freedom are light. They have zero rest mass, and there is a large number of them. That basically means that, however, you know, if you take any black hole, however heavy and cold it is, right? It will always emit all, it can always access these, it can always thermalize with all of these, you know, large number of CFT degrees of freedom simply because there is no gap to gravity. So it can dump entropy into them and lose mass. So now, according to Maldacena ADS CFT, bulk solution then should automatically account for this. If you're looking for a bulk configuration that should represent a black hole in the dual theory, then that bulk configuration, because it includes planar diagrams, already takes that into account. Now, from the classical point of view, what do we think is the classical bulk dual description? See, the point is that the brain is accelerating towards the ADS boundary. If you stick a black hole on it, you try to stick a black hole on it, you take the massive object and you're pushing it with some force away from the center of ADS space, which is where it would naturally want to be. That means you have to accelerate a massive object which actually has a non-zero quadrupole through the bulk, and as any gravitating object with a non-zero time-dependent quadrupole due to acceleration, it will emit classical gravitational waves. Alright? So, you know, just as a motivation, not to say that this is the full picture.
Why isn't that true in four dimensions?
Good question.
Why doesn't your quantum correction 3D black hole behave like ultraviolet?
Difficult question, I don't know. All right?
But, you know, because that would be Hawking radiation in 3D.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
so
he's
saying
gravitational
radiation in four dimensions goes to the radiation.
Well, we have some conjectures that it had to do with special properties of the symmetric in ADS4, where, you know, I'll credit Roberto with something I don't understand fully. He had some guesses that, in fact, it was the existence of this string, which is singular, which has been excluded by the insertion of the brain. So there's something like a singular strut, actually, which is holding these metrics running towards the ADS3 bulk, which is rendering this configuration static. But, you know, I really should say that we don't know.
Okay.
In the 3D case, it's precisely by including the quantum stress tensor that you get a solution to begin with, a black hole to begin with. So presumably they've included all of the sort of one of the effects.
There is also pre-effect, Steve. I'm confused. My first reaction would be some sensors. The reason I'm confused is there is, I mean, I think his point is there is a pre-effect. You still start with this you know, thin cone on the brain that you hurl through the Balkan, it's somehow accelerating through the Balkan, you would think that should also gravitationally radiate.
Yeah, on the classical side.
Right, on the classical
side. That's right, I agree. Right. Yeah, right.
Bulk, of course, bulk Hawking radiation is irrelevant because it's actually higher order in the you know, diagram expansion, so we need not worry about it at this level. So now, okay, the claim is that bulk solutions automatically take this into account, so because they should therefore describe a black hole corrected by the back reaction from CFT Hawking radiation. The escaping radiation steals energy, therefore mass, from the black hole, which is time-dependent, and hence the black hole itself should be time-dependent. What's a check of this, right? Now, of course, you know, checking this is extremely hard because we don't have exact solutions on either side. So now, you know, you have to look for things to compare and make sure you're not comparing apples and oranges, basically. So, a very loose check, where we could at least argue to understand the scalings, comes from taking this claimed obstruction to finding the static solutions that arises when you try to collapse a cloud of dust and describe its dynamics by using the bulk equations projected on the four-dimensional boundary, and then trying to find a different solution to which you can match, and ensuring that the anomaly coefficient in the dual theory in the CFT on the interior and the exterior are the same. Okay. Here is the picture. So imagine. So we are only talking about the dual theory. The only place where the bulk comes in is to the fact that it tells us what this term is by taking the into account these higher order corrections coming from the CFT PCP. So we take a CFT cloud, we let it collapse, eventually it will form a black hole, and if we arrive, it will radiate. Now, how should we describe that geometry? Well, interior should be, as again Oppenheimer and Snyder taught us, some collapsing cloud of CFT gas that includes some leading order quantum corrections. And if you believe ADS, CFT in Kato ADS spaces, those corrections have been computed. And that's this claimed obstruction that violates the Birkhoff theorem. The exterior, however, should be described by an outgoing YDS solution, very, very far away from the black hole, which essentially corresponds to a black hole corrected by a flux of radiation running away towards infinity. And this assumes that the quantum state for this radiation is the unruled state, which has a regular future horizon. And then we can describe that flux of radiation basically just by the stress energy tensor that corresponds to radiation fluid far away. The problem, the technical problem which arises in the calculation is, you know that even though very far away, you expect the solution to be outgoing by idea, there are going to be some kind of, you know, in between regions where it's going to deviate from that outgoing idea in a rather strong way. If you go, for example, to the near horizon limit, you should find actually something like ingoing idea corresponding to some CFT rescattering and coming back into the black hole. And also there is some kind of in between region where, you know, things are really messy. So what we did is, to leading order, we imagine that we take a very, very big black hole. These effects, you know, from complicated deformations of the geometry tend to be suppressed by inverse mass. So if you take a very large mass, at least to leading order, you might hope to extract the scalings, nothing more than that. All right? The coefficients are totally unreliable. So it's all dimensional analysis at this point. So then you try to match this interior solution with, you know, these simplifying assumptions to an exterior idea. And you find that you can do that if you choose the luminosity of the outgoing radiation to be set by the black hole parameters in this formula. Right, where in fact, you know, this of course, there was really the G5 sitting in here, which I've eliminated in favor of G4 and so on and so forth. So the amazing thing, of course, is this exactly scales like an outgoing flux of CFT, G-star flavors of CFT that's flying out through the black hole. And so at least we met. The other thing that's interesting, this check, and that, you know, I'll give you some kind of, well, answer, the criterion that we were using for the consistency of the check, which also told us one of the reasons why people have failed to find these static black holes in the earlier attempts. The point is that if you want to match the exterior solution that you're trying to describe by using classical bulk equations, all right, that should correspond to some CFT corrected dual geometry, and on the outers, on the outside, you put basically what you expect CFT should do. You at least should check that the anomaly coefficients for both sides match up, so that you know that you're matching solutions that can arise in the same theory. If the anomaly coefficients inside and outside are different, then these, you know, geometries correspond to geometries living in different theories, and we can't match them in the first place. Which is basically what people looking for static black holes had actually tried to do. Now, so if you calculate the conformal anomaly, you'll actually find out that on both sides this turns out to be zero. And so indeed, the conditions are consistently satisfied. Assuming, of course, that the, you know, that the spectral contents of the CFT is exactly the same as in exactly the, you know, CFT case without, you know, losing any degrees of freedom from the CFT to things like supersymmetry breaking and so on and so forth. So in this case, then this theorem, this claimed theorem, actually does indeed become easy to understand, because, you know, all there is to it is that you have to include corrections, but because the corrections involve a large number of master degrees of freedom and are of quantum nature, they should include effects from quantum conditions and be two time dependent black holes. And this is the reason why I, you know, think that I mean, I'm inclined to think at the moment at least that static black hole solutions don't exist. Because I don't know, you know, in order to find them, I have to ignore the Hawking radiation. How could I do that? Well, the way to do it is to provide a CFT with a gap. So that means I can't have a geometry in the bulk which is asymptotic ADS. I need to have a singular geometry. Or put another gradient, so on and so forth. Then when I have a gap, I will find black holes which are static, which are big enough so that their temperature is smaller than the gap. Okay. But, you know, as long as their temperature is bigger than the gap, I have to thermalize with those degrees of freedom. And CFT in the, you know, CFT must be taken into account because bulk equations by ADS CFT already do it for us. So now, you know, one of the questions, okay, I should really, you know, this is not fair because I'm not really sure whether our thinking has been evolving. I'm not sure whether we now agree with this, but at least as a curious estimate, you know. So if we now think about the classical picture, you know, what is the classical bulk effect that corresponds, you know, that tells us that there should be some kind of time dependence and energy loss? It's this gravitational branch problem, all right? We have an accelerating object running through the bulk. It should emit gravity waves. And the one thing that we could do is estimate, well, at which frequency to do it. And the frequency is basically set by the inverse gravitational length of the system, all right? And if you take into account the pancaking of the black hole and appropriately compute the volume of the space that black hole occupies because it's stuck to the brain, and, you know, work the formulas through, you actually find out that, you know, the frequency at which it emits is essentially, it scales like the Hawking temperature. It's, again, a funny numerical concept. Of course, why, I don't understand. I don't think we understand it. So just, I guess, for fun, this is, I would say, as much about the theoretical motivation and our understanding of the theory behind it as we can now say. But assuming this is right, what are the implications for phenomenology? We've seen a lot of interest in phenomenology of brain worlds, and in particular these type of ABS spaces. And black holes actually turn out to have a very interesting phenomenological application because I was speaking with Scott earlier, but it's sort of ironic that actually the darkest objects in the world turn out to shed most light on these problems, at least in some aspect. And so that was a fun thing, all right? So what's the story, what's the status? Ignore black holes for a moment and ask, okay, so how many degrees in the CFT, if you believe Randall's Wonder 2 is the theory of the world, can you tolerate? How many could there be without anything going wrong? And if you, for example, consider corrections to Newtonian potential, the strongest bounds now come from the Seattle experiment, from Adler and Berger's experiment, which tell us that there should be no corrections, no deviations from Newton's law, down to distances about 0.1 millimeter, with a strength comparable to that of gravity. And when you look at the corrections which you get in Randall's Wonder 2 from the bulk degrees of freedom, remember that they went as L squared over R squared. You put in this requirement here, and you find that it gives you a bound on L that, as long as it's less than about 0.1 millimeter, you know, there are no effects at low energy physics. What that means is that in the CFT, you end up having 10 to the 60 degrees of freedom that you don't see. I mean, that's very funny. The reason is the tunneling suppression. Okay, the reason is really that, I mean, you know, you make the extra degrees of freedom invisible in two ways. Either you give them masses or you make them couple very quickly to the visible stuff. These guys are massless, all right? But they couple extremely quickly to everything because of the tunneling suppression. Remember, these degrees of freedom from the bulk perturbation theory point, we have to break through the barrier in order to couple to stuff that lives on the brain, and that is going to be, the coupling will be proportional to the mass times the ADS radius, and so it can be very big.
This precisely means SU 10 to the 60, right? If I'm thinking an ADS CFT.
So now.
Oh, SU 10 to the 30? G stars N squared.
Right, sorry, it's N squared.
This is N squared, okay.
Not that it makes much difference, right? Now you may say, okay, so well, you know, what about cosmology? We know, for example, that many of the strongest bounds on new physics are from, let's say, nucleosynthesis, right? From C and B, from, you know, a number of things. Nucleosynthesis is actually perhaps the best problem because we know it well. And so that you know, tells you a constraint, okay, that given such a large number of degrees of freedom, nucleosynthesis tells you that the total number of these that have been put in equilibrium with the rest of the universe at some early time cannot be bigger than the number of photons, let's say roughly. We will be liberal with the precise numerical statements. And that means that as long as today, since there are so many of them, as long as they're colder than about 10 to the minus 5, 15 Kelvin, you don't see any effect. Now that, of course, is a ridiculously small temperature. But, you know, people building models of cosmology are inventive. They can come up with models that will not excite more than this. In particular, if you actually have inflation happen at some very high scale and somehow you have heating only on the brain, and then you consider gravitational production of the CFT degrees of freedom by, let's say, collision processes on the brain, those will emit some bulk gravitons that will fly off into the bulk. But as long as, if you consider cosmological effects, all right, as long as L is, the ADS radius is less than about a millimeter, you won't excite more than, you know, the number of CFT degrees of freedom which will not violate this bulk. So in other words, your answer for that again is they're weakly coupled and gravity is feeble, so these processes are slow. However, black holes are actually very sensitive to these degrees of freedom. I mean, basically, the point is that they accelerate, they detonate big black holes. They accelerate their evaporation. Thermodynamic picture that we have in mind is that if you have one of these black holes and you live in a universe where you're essentially bathing in the background radiation.
Yes. During inflation, you would have a de Sitter Hawk temperature
span
of these 10 to the 60 particles.
Right.
That sounds like a lot of energy. And also a lot of it would survive after inflation.
Tell you
very low trajectory scale, or that they not smog the other entities in the problem?
You know, they can be, in fact, a number, all right, is going to be, what's the right way to think about it? Think about, I guess, think about the Hubble law. Let's assume that inflation happens at a scale which is below the ADS scale, just for simplicity, so that you can use four-dimensional coordinates. So the temperature of the, you know, the CFT guys which are in the equilibrium with the desiderate environment will actually be very low. The reason is that, I'm wrong. Okay, that's not right.
Said by the Hubble scalar.
Yeah, it's set by the Hubble scalar.
Doesn't matter. It's just like, what he basically has at the end of the day is a very big CFT of the gravity. So wherever it's going on, he gets thermal implications of those norms.
Are they produced
during
inflation?
But if they're all in their vacuum states, they're being zero.
No, they can't be.
But you don't get.
What can not be in the
what is the effective way they couple to force gravity? Fluctuations.
No, they couple to force gravity in a normal way, you know.
Standard way.
Standard way, by equivalence principle. They couple, like the photon, like everything.
But they don't seemingly couple to
gravity. So in some sense, because of the certain temperature, these things don't actually.
There's this big, for scalars, there's an R phi squared term.
Okay.
Where R is the desiderate R.
This is a cutoff theory in your own physics and beyond the cutoff.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Since we're over time, I'll probably go back to this.
I'll try to think. Yes. Anyway, so let's ignore that. Bottom line, so suppose you live in a world where you're bathing in the CMB. And CFT is very cold in order to agree with the current balance so that it does not disturb things like nucleosynthesis. In the absence of the black hole, the transition from CMB into CFT is very small. However, if you have a black hole, it serves basically like a piston that opens up a one-way route from the CMB into the CFT cap. And so, the question is now essentially to calculate the rate of energy transfer.
Is this a virtual black hole?
No, well, let's say it's just a big astrophysical black hole.
But you would also induce direct coupling?
Well, the virtual black holes will lead to quantum corrections that I don't know how to keep under control. Here, with the classical black holes, at least I know how to say things consistently. Now, so what the black hole will do is, it will, because it's surrounded by CMB, it will accrete CMB in, because generally speaking, CMB may be hot enough, black hole may be big enough to suck some of it in. But on the other hand, because CFT is so cold, black hole will just emit the CMB. So to get the idea about the balance is you write down the equation for the time derivative of the mass of the black hole. And this is something you learn from an old paper by Carr and Hawking, I think from 74. And here, so what is this? This is the evaporation process. This is the CFT going out, proportional to Hawking temperature, area of the black hole, and the number of CFT degrees of freedom. And you know, for precision, you put the gray body factor, which for super young Mills with this for these degrees of freedom relative for the CFT turns out to be 4 to the 10 to the minus 5 when you compute it. And this term corresponds to the acquisition of energy by the black hole from the surrounding CMB. Again, it's going to be proportional to the energy density of the environment. That's CMB to the 4th power, temperature times the area. And so now you say, okay, what is the temperature of the CMB at which, below which, this term is negligible compared to this one? You may say, okay, what about black holes that live in very dense nebulas and whatnot? Let's ignore it for a moment, and essentially the numbers will justify why I can do that. So if you take this and essentially, well, try to look for the critical value for TCMB where it's less than, where the accretion is smaller than the evaporation, you find, for example, for a black hole of the solar mass size, 10 to the 57 GeV, that in fact this term dominates over this term for the CMB temperatures below MeV. So even if you're a very, very dense, oh, assuming that the ADS radius is, let's say, close to its bound, about 0.1 million. Right? So even at very, very dense environments, where the energy density is MeV to the fourth, you can still ignore accretion, because you lose so many CFTDs of freedom. In other words, this is how dense you have to get the environment of the black hole to prevent it from developing. So if, again, the ADS radius is close to its bound that is imposed by tabletop experiments, a large black hole will end up radiating for most of its adult life. So ignoring then the accretion, we can solve the differential equation, get the lifetime of the black hole due to the evaporation of the CFT, and we get, of course, the usual formula except for this term, which now can be extremely big. I gave you the number 10 to the 6th. And so the trick is, if you look at that, so where are the strongest sources of bounds? So astrophysicist colleagues tell us that they expect that there should actually at least exist a couple of black holes with masses in the range of few solar masses for at least about a billion years, so they can understand the X-ray binaries. When we translate that in the equation for the lifetime, we get that the number of CFTDs of freedom can be bigger than about 10 to the 52, which is 8 to the magnitude reduction from tabletop experiments. And that actually gives us, if you translate it into the statement of the ADS radius, a bound, an upper bound on the ADS radius, which is about 0.1 micron, which is about 3 orders of magnitude improvement over Radl-Berger. Not much, but at least if somebody tells you that those, that Randall's syndrome 2 is a motivation for those experiments, well, it's not.
How do we know that's for a million years? A billion years?
Well, there are some people who, there is actually variable opinions from searching the literature. Apparently, some people tell us that they should be at least around for about 10 million years, given what they think is the evolution of the binary systems. Some other people disagree. They say they have to be around for at least a billion years. Again, that depends on the precise models of the evolution of the binaries.
But, I mean, regardless, what is the reason why we think that they have to be around that long?
Because they think that the binary system needed, so much to form. You need to first form, the stars that go in there, the black hole, a number of things. Now, of course, lots of details are not totally under control because of the, people not knowing how long it really takes to form a star, collapse it into a black hole, and then get that black hole, to trap another partner. But those kinds of arguments suggest that at least, from searching the literature, we found at least 10 billion years up to few billion years, so we decided to take a number in the middle, all right? Even if we take 10 million years, we actually get an improvement over Radl-Berger and company by about 1.5 orders. Now, the strongest bound would actually come if somebody were to show that there are primordial black holes with macroscale masses. Now, there were a number of people that were arguing that such things might exist in the halo of our galaxy because of some discrepancies with accounting for the dark matter in the form of machos. And the reason we actually put this estimate in here is that the GEO-600 gravity wave detector in Germany had put it in their manifesto that they can look for these things. All right, so they want to look for binary mass, binaries with 0.1, 0.2, 0.few solar masses, right? And if they were to find one, then we would say that actually that improves the bound on ADS radius down to about a few nanometers. The reason the bound goes up is you get a smaller black hole, which is therefore hotter and emits faster. And also it has to be, if it's a primordial, if it's 0.1 solar masses, then it had to form in the early universe because of the Chandrasekhar bound. Okay, you could not get it by collapse, all right? So it had to be around for 10 billion years. And in that case, you get the best bound, which would improve over the FH experiment by about 100,000. The most fun thing, which, this is the comic relief, right? A possible way for detection would be to look for things that look like, huge gravitational slingshots. you know, suppose, just for fun, that the ADS radius is close to its allowed bound, and there are therefore some black holes in binary systems which just go poof today, or maybe did it a million years ago. And what that would do is essentially it would then release from the orbiter partner and have it swung through the space at very large, you know, abnormally large speeds. And, you know, because the black hole would go into a wisp of hot dark matter that would not be able to confine the partner in the orbit anymore. All right, so in light of the late moment, I'll just put this transparency and finish here.
So I understand from what you're saying that in this kind of picture, when black holes decay, we don't see anything because most of it goes into radiation
that's
just out there in infinite Randall Sundrum space.
Basically.
So does this do things to bounds on primordial black holes?
Yes.
Because now some of those come from not seeing stuff.
Absolutely. One of the things, so we think, yes, indeed. If assuming this is right, then we think that many of those cosmological models, well, the bound is conditional. Many of the cosmological models that produce a large number of primordial black holes would lead to strong bounds on ADS radius. But you see, that's in which it sort of goes around. I mean, if you take ADS radius and make it very, very close to the Planck scale, you lose all of this. I mean, numerically, the effects are qualitatively there, but you have relatively few degrees of freedom and no bounds whatsoever. So there is a sliding scale of those.
So a couple of questions. One is, if you think about the classical evolution in the book, what is really going on? Presumably it's not the black hole shrinking, right? Because that would sort of violate singularity theorems, cosmic censorship if it shrunk down to zero sum. So do you have any picture of how you get something that looks like a shrinking black hole in 4D and
so
5D is not shrinking?
So this is one of the puzzles that we've been, you know, we've been losing sleep a little bit. I'll tell you a modification of the picture that we are slightly slowly converging to. We're still not sure whether it's completely right, but imagine the following setup. So let's not look at an isolated black hole in, you know, surrounded by a vacuum. Let's look at some black hole in some cosmological background. In that would, you know, where we have, let's say, some sort of FRW cosmology in a universe that is filled with, you know, CFT at some temperature, which now, in other words, the bulk picture should be some ADS Schwarzschild black hole, which we cut with the brain. And in the case we would maybe want to look at the, you know, most symmetric solution, the brain would move towards the boundary in a way that would mimic the cosmological evolution. There was a paper by, I think, Gubser, you know, number of people that considered these things. Okay? So of course, that would just correspond to radiation dominated FRW universe in the world. Now imagine that, you know, by hook or by crook, we generate a very large perturbation in that universe. In a sense, we think of it as, you know, taking the brain and sort of pushing it with our finger towards the bulk, you know, very strongly. And that perturbation, under the force of that perturbation, the brain bends in, and one portion of the brain bends in where the finger pressed it and starts going towards the bulk black hole. And at some point, it touches the bulk black hole and horizon forms on the brain. And then we would say what happened in the dual theory is that the perturbation grew. And then overdensity became large, and it formed a black hole.
Oh, I see.
Now what happens is, okay, so now, on the other hand, the brain has tension. It doesn't want to stay, you know, with one of its ends stuck in the center of ADS space when the rest is accelerating towards the boundary. So it wants to straighten out. So, but now it's glued to the bulk black hole. And, you know, as it straightens towards the boundary, it pulls along with it the bulk black hole away from the center. The bulk black hole, of course, doesn't want to go to the ADS boundary because it's heavy. It wants to fall back in the center. So the horizon starts stretching, and you get something like a string. Now, you see, so there is a portion, therefore, of the horizon on the brain that seems to be shrinking without violating the area theorems. Now, the question is what happens, so what part of this process do we now think corresponds to the evolution of the large black hole? Well, actually, we were extremely confused about what to do here because of the Maeda-Horowitz, or rather Horowitz-Maeda result, which was telling us that this process of breaking up of the string can actually slow down and become very, 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 very slow. In other words, the string doesn't really like to detach as long as you have null energy conditions satisfied. But you see, the thing is that there is this initial process where the brain just slammed into the black hole, where the black string starts growing, and it grows pretty fast. At that point, the horizon, at the moment of contact, the horizon is still big. So we think it is that initial fast process that corresponds to the stage where the black hole is large, in the dual theory is large and loses energy rapidly. Then eventually the string thins down, and the further shrinking of the string slows down extremely dramatically. That is actually consistent with this picture in the following sense. If you take a big black hole and you allow it to lose energy, you know, by however you want, at some point it becomes smaller than the ADS radius. At that point, the temperature becomes bigger than the cutoff, and CFT description fails completely. Exactly. So you have to go into the UV resolution. The simplest UV resolution hand is simply the bulk gravity picture, which is still well defined as long as the black hole is bigger than the 5D Planck length. So you end up basically with a small black hole that lives on the brain in much, you know, in essentially what looks like flat extra dimensions for it because its size is smaller than the ADS curvature. We know that those black holes actually now evaporate very slowly because they mostly evaporate along the brain because of the S vapor here. And now we think, okay, so this is the way to reconcile this with Horowitz-Maeda slowdown of the breakup of the string.
I see. So it shrinks to the cutoff size and then it.
And then it just sort of hangs around.
Breaking
and
leading approximation.
Right. It's
in classical.
That's right. So, you know, there will be actually, we do think there will be black holes that are static or nearly static, but they've got to be very small. They've got to be smaller than the ADS radius. Actually, such examples were found numerically by Tanaka and Nakamura, I think, and a student from Kyoto.
We also discussed them in this linearized
solution.
When you're looking for not finding static black holes, why don't you find one where there's enough radiation coming in, right, that exactly balances the Hawking radiation coming out?
We do. That's in one of the cases that I did not discuss, that is ADS-3 brain embedded in ADS-4 bulk. And also we think in higher dimensional generalizations, we think that should be exactly the situation, one of the possible outcomes. The point is that if you take a black hole that's big enough but embedded in a ADS space, that will naturally realize the situation that actually corresponds to Hartle-Hawking bulk. And there indeed are black holes in ADS, three brains in ADS-4 that seem to look like that, but again, we don't. We think that such solutions should exist.
So,
but
this correspondence between acceleration radiation from the black hole in the bulk and the Hawking radiation on the brain.
Yes.
If you imagine now imparting a bit of, say, angular momentum or charge to the black hole, it seems to go the wrong way, right? In the bulk, it seems you should lose energy faster, but on the boundary, it seems you should Hawking radiate slower.
We don't think, you know, I as I said, when I actually talked about gravity waves, I put a question mark. We're not sure whether that picture is correct because of this evolution of the string picture. So we think that this evolution of the string has to play some role that we do not understand. The other problem that we saw that is, you know, purely bulk emission of classical bulk waves is we were clueless as to how would that ever restore thermality in the dual theory. So, you know, something else probably needs to be put in there. And we think now this string evolution, you know, with the string you have essentially some extended distribution to the box, so when you sum it up you might, because of it, you know, the energy contributions coming from different places in the top being redshifted at different rates depending on the position, that might be thermal.
Any other questions? Thank you again.